Welcome to Traverse Legal Radio, the Tech Lawyer Podcast, a show dedicated to helping entrepreneurs, CEOs, and founders navigate legal issues, grow revenue, and increase their valuation. This podcast is sponsored by the IP and litigation attorneys at Traverse Legal PLC. Visit traverselegal.com to learn how Traverse Legal's attorneys are changing the way law is practiced. Now, here's your host, trial attorney Enrico Schaefer.
Welcome to the Tech Law Podcast. My name is attorney Enrico Schaefer. I specialize in technology company representation. And today on the show, we've got a special guest, Lori Orton Heath. Lori is of counsel to Traverse Legal and specializes in corporate and technology law issues. And today she's going to be helping us understand a little bit about the CPG industry and the different types of legal issues that CPG companies should be thinking about as they go from idea to startup to early stage funding and hopefully to $200 million in revenue. So welcome to the show, Lori.
Hi, Enrico. Thank you.
Lori, why don't you just give us a little bit of your background and expertise before we jump in here and start learning a little bit about CPG?
Sure. Currently, as you mentioned, I'm a CPG attorney, and I work with a lot of different startup companies. Some of them are further down the road than others. But prior to becoming an attorney, I actually worked for Nestle USA. And during that time, I was in sales and marketing, and I had the really great good fortune to start out actually as a sales representative in Houston, Texas, and then I ended up moving into some other more kind of sophisticated responsibilities, and that included directing national headquarter operations for major wholesalers and retailers in Texas, and some of those are Albertsons, HEB, Kroger, some that you may recognize the name or some of the listeners may recognize. I also managed a retail offices for Nestle, and that included managing full and part-time sales teams. So I was able to leverage that business experience with Nestle, and then I moved into the medical device space with a company called Boston Scientific. And then from there, I went on to work for other companies such as GE Healthcare and St. Jude Medical, and also some smaller startup medical device companies. Over the course of that time, I was in Minnesota working for a medical technology company called St. Jude Medical, and I decided to go to law school. And that's when I became an attorney. And so I've been very lucky to be able to kind of merge my technical business experience with being an attorney. And I'm also able to rely on that retail experience that I really honed initially with Nestle to advise clients that are looking for attorneys who specialize in CPG. So it's been a good kind of experience for me, and it's led me to this.
Perfect. And you know, at Traverse Legal, we really love to bring in resources, attorneys, paralegals who have a specialized background and are also an attorney, also a lawyer, because for the clients that are in these different spaces, whether it's open source software licensing or whatever, to actually have someone who writes code in open source or to have someone who's got a lot of experience in consumer packaged goods already is invaluable to clients. And it turns out that you speak their language. You are actually have a really good insight into the business model itself. And so you're not just there to analyze legal issues. So let's talk a little bit about consumer packaged goods, also known as CPG. I've seen numbers, Lori, of industry worth trillions of dollars. What is CPG from your point of view, and what does that market look like?
CPG means a lot of different things to different people. You know, for just the initial sort of definition of it, CPG stands for consumer packaged goods, which doesn't sound as cool as saying CPG. So we'll say CPG, I guess, for the purposes of our talk today. But for most people, when they think of CPG, they think, well, what does that include? And for the average consumer, if you walk into your local store, maybe it's Whole Foods or Target or Walmart, really anything that would be in a major retailer, such as those types of stores, would be a CPG product. You've got food and beverages, cereal, flavored waters. You've got beauty and personal health care items like shampoos and shaving creams. And you also have household products like dishwasher detergent and furniture polish.
And where you really specialize is getting the companies from idea and startup into these big box stores, into the mainstream of consumer goods.
Yeah, that's right. And so a lot of times, you know, most early stage CPG companies, it starts with an idea and maybe it's a founder or more than, you know, there's maybe a couple of founders. And oftentimes I'll work with people who maybe came up with a recipe, and it's a recipe maybe that was passed down to them in their family, and they've started to make it for friends and family, that, you know, particular recipe, and maybe they're making it in their own kitchen. And they start to get traction with that, and they think, well, gosh, this is really good, and I'm getting great feedback from people on it, and they love it. So could this be a product I could put in a store? And then from there, they, you know, it's figuring out how to do that. And it's not necessarily a straight line. I mean, there's lots of things that come into it. One would think getting it in a store might be sort of, if it's a great product, and people want to use it, that would be easy to do, but that's not necessarily true. So there's lots of things that CPG companies can do to help leverage their good product into stores. And really, networking is one of the main things that can help them do that. But there's other things that they can do as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because you and I see it all the time because we work with so many startup and early stage companies. There are a lot of great ideas, great products, maybe the best product in its class ever, but they never make it, right? Because you've got all the business side issues, you've got the funding issues, you've got to make sure that you get all of the different seats filled with the expertise that you need across the board, from professional services, lawyers, accountants, on down to the sales and marketing and product development. So there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle. Talk a little bit about how a CPG company, an early stage or an idea company, is going to typically get funded and grow.
So a lot of times these companies will start out, and maybe the founder or the founders have some money, and they're typically going to, you know, the chance that they may come upon an investor that will invest in the company, that or a rich uncle or aunt, that's, you know, that can happen, but it's not typical. And so a lot of times these early companies will have one of the founders, or both of the founders, will actually leave. If they're going to make it really, you know, big step into their business, they're going to leave their day-to-day job, or one of the founders will stay in the day-to-day job, or the other one will commit the time to the business while the one in the day-to-day job is funding, you know, what needs to be done. And so they're using a lot of their own money. They're establishing credit lines on behalf of the company. And oftentimes, friends and family will come in, and they'll pitch in and provide money or credit lines. I think it's important to mention here that friends and family are often very helpful to early stage CPG companies, but it's very important to find an attorney who specializes in early stage companies, whether they are as a CPG attorney or just a business attorney who specializes with small companies, who helps them document any provision of money that may be given to the company. Because you want to protect the parties, you want to protect the founders, you want to protect the person that's loaning the money, and you also want to protect the business. You don't want, you know, down the road to have Emily, who founded the company, and Uncle Joe gave her $10,000. 5 years from now, you don't want to be there to be a misunderstanding where Uncle Joe thinks he has a stake in the business, and Emily doesn't believe Uncle Joe has that stake. And that can be a potential problem later with investors that come along who want to understand, you know, who actually owns part of the business. So getting a good attorney who specializes in CPG or in business matters can help you document that.
Yeah, Lori, and it's really been fascinating to me through the years to watch these different types of companies grow. And I tend to put, you know, companies into two boxes. The first is, you know, the napkin business people, right? They're gonna grow out of revenue. They're self-funding. They can do everything on a napkin, and you know what? It tends to work. As problems come up, they solve them. The napkin approach doesn't work for anyone that's going to be taking in money, or especially multiple rounds of money, because whoever's coming in second is going to want to see all of the corporate documents. They're going to demand that they be lined up, that everyone, that all the prior money that's come in, that all of that's defined by contract, that non-competes exist with all the right employees, and they're going to do due diligence, and they're going to do a risk assessment before they put that money in. So you're building a foundation, of documents that you can then build upon as you go through the different financing rounds. What have you seen in that regard?
That's a really good point, and everything you said is exactly how it should happen. And it's very typical for, the early stage believers in the company who want to invest, whether they be family or friends. Typically we don't see so much where they're asking, who's already in the company. Sometimes they're the very first people besides the founders who have put money in. But when you start moving up to angel investors and onto other groups of more, I'll call them sophisticated investors, they're going to want to do exactly what you've just said, which is their due diligence. They're going to want to see who's already invested in the company, what their stake is in the company. They're also going to want to see what risks the company has taken. What are their relationships? Do they have employees? Are they independent contractors? Are there non-competes in place? I mean, if there's a secret sauce recipe, is that being protected so that that can't be, taken and used in another way that's not connected with the company? And all that ties in, and we can talk about that as well, but all that ties into protecting your brand equity. And I would suggest here that it's important to also tie this in not only with a good business attorney or CPG attorney, but also with a good intellectual property attorney, someone that can help you protect that brand equity, with a name or slogan or logo or, all the different things that you've built around your brand.
It's so funny that, the conversations you have with some of these founders and inventors and these idea people as they get through the various stages of growth. How much different is it in your experience in working with companies who actually lined everything up right at the beginning versus having to clean them up later once there's a $10 million round coming down the pipe?
That is a really good point, and the short answer is it makes a huge difference, because sometimes there's investors that will come in and they like a company, they like the founders, they like the products, but they don't see good documentation. And it doesn't mean they don't trust the founders or believe in the product. To put it kind of in a short statement, it may be as much as them saying this is too big of a hassle. There's other companies we can invest in. We may not like the founders as much, but they've really got their ducks in a row. This is going to make it easy for our investors to want to put their arms around this. They're going to want to put the money in. We can get this transaction done quickly. And so sometimes, the documentation can help kind of put the bow on the package when you've got everything else going right. You've got good founders. You've got people that believe in the product. You've got a great product. Consumers love the product. But you just got to get the bow on the package with the documentation and get that in order. And that can make the difference between a deal going through and not.
And one of the things that these companies sometimes fail to appreciate is there's always some cleanup at a funding round, right? But that is time away from doing what you really want and need to be doing, which is growing your company and working on distribution problems and retail problems and packaging problems and IP problems. And you really get diverted when you have to go through a funding round on the things that the people who are bringing the money want to see done. And so it really can become a time suck and a distraction. And you don't really know whether they're going to put the money in until you get everything cleaned up. So you're always making that decision as to, am I going to devote the time and resources to get all these documents together in order to pursue this potential investment round, or am I going to work on my business and try and drive revenue? If you've got everything set up as a foundation from the beginning and all the prior angel investors know exactly what their rights are and it's all documented, no one's fighting about it later and using it as leverage, you're just in such a better position to take in that next funding round.
That's exactly right. And I think for purposes of the founders themselves, oftentimes You know, if you've got a really good team of founders, or at least one founder who then brings on a friend or someone else that maybe perhaps is performing the function of a business manager, you can divide up those tasks. And, you know, perhaps one founder is more the face of the company, where they get out, they meet investors, they go to trade shows, they set up booths and sell products at, you know, big events or at, you know, county fairs or a farmer's market, that type of thing. And then you have the other one who's keeping the ducks in the row, who's, you know, managing the funds as they come in, and they're controlling the expenses. They know how they're spending the money. They know what their production costs are going to be. They know what they are today and what they're going to be in 6 months. And so they've got a good system going, and they've got a good team. And to me, those are usually the companies that do very well, because they've got sort of not only this agreement in place, whether, you know, that's documented or not, but it's just an understanding between the two where they're going to function in a certain way, and that's going to be the best for the business. And it often works well.
Well, you know, one of the fascinating things to me, Lori, is in your space. So I, as you know, I'm more in the intellectual property and the trademark and space. I do a lot of litigation, but I also help companies who are in the tech area grow. I don't do the same type of corporate work that you do, so I'm not setting up all the documents in order to take in this investment money, et cetera. So you've got that area of specialization for your clients. But what I find fascinating is it's different in consumer packaged goods than it is for a software development company or for a service company that's going to be offering software as a service, right? You know, here we're talking about tangible goods, consumer packaged goods. What kind of unique issues do CPG companies face in your experience that they need to be thinking about from the beginning?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, because we are talking about tangible goods, and we're talking about, you know, products that you make in a kitchen that over time perhaps you get some funding or you get a credit line, and now you're working in a commercial kitchen. Well, now you've got production going, and you're becoming more sophisticated. Well, there's risks associated with that production. You've now got to, or you should put in an agreement in place in a contract form with this commercial kitchen. Anybody that's touching the ingredients that are going to make your product, you should have an agreement in place to protect not only the recipe for your product, but protect really the parties, both parties, so you understand the responsibilities of each party. And so you've got risks not only in production, but you've got the risks really through the whole line of the process of the product being produced, commercialized, say, for example, in the commercial kitchen space that we talked about, and then taking that product and actually putting it on a shelf at a retailer. And then the next, of course, it's certainly not a problem. It's a happy occurrence when the consumer picks up your product and buys it and takes it home. You've got to make sure that your product is risk-free, in that consumer is going to purchase your product, use your product, and enjoy your product without having any, you know, anything bad happen. And so that's a really can be a real risk and problem for CPG companies, where they've got products that have shelf lives. You've got to manage the shelf life of the product. When does the product expire? When do you want to take it off the shelf so the consumer doesn't purchase it and have something that potentially could be a bad product? You're obviously not producing good products to make the American consumer sick. So you've got to really be aware of the risks all along the lines of not only production, manufacturing, but production, and then also ultimately retail, and then ultimately into the consumer's hands.
What is it that you've seen, Lori, in your experience as a commercial attorney, as a commercial attorney that really has a lot of experience in CPG? What is it that you bring to the table based on your experience that you think really makes a difference for clients?
I think the biggest difference, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, is, you know, from the days that I worked for Nestle Foods, you know, having a good understanding of what makes a quality product and getting that product in front of the American consumer and how you go about doing that, that in itself is not something that's easy to do. I had, like I said, the good fortune of working for a major corporation and a manufacturer. So at some level, you have some entree to retailers because they know who you are. So the challenge for, you know, a good CPG company that's starting out and good CPG companies is really being smart about how they market their product and getting it into retailers. And a lot of the really good smart CPG companies, even the small ones, know how to begin marketing their product through social media. So I can speak to the social media portion of it. I can speak to the challenge of getting in front of a retailer. And then I can speak to the risks associated with the product as an attorney and how you want to document and protect your company and yourself, and then also how you want to protect your product, not only for your sake, but also for the sake of the consumer that's going to buy your product. So really all of those different considerations are something that I've had experience in, and it's something that, you know, I can communicate with and share with clients when I meet with them and talk through all the different aspects of it.
Well, and one of the things that I see in every niche in today's, you know, evolving world with all these different innovations that are just keep coming at us is that, you know, if you're a client and you're a CPG startup and you've got this great product and you're trying to figure out how to take it from, I think this product is great, to someone's shelf, right? We use the word shelf now, and it means something different than it meant before, because it could be an Amazon sale. It could be a Facebook ad that drives the sale. It could be you could be going through a fulfillment center that's storing your goods and handling all the fulfillment items. You know, one of the things that is out there is that you could go with a really, you know, older attorney that knows how things used to be done in CPG, but chances are they're not sophisticated in social media and some of the new e-commerce platforms that are out there that could be the predominant issue, the predominant distribution model that this CPG company is going to use in order to get into the hands of consumers. Or you could go with a really young attorney that understands the new distribution models and e-commerce models, but just doesn't have the experience. So finding someone that's been around for a while, but still has taken the time to understand the new and emerging markets is hard to do. It's harder than you would think. And you're right in that space. So tell us a little bit about how you take the old school and how you've managed to stay up with the new emerging distribution, retail, web-based tools that are out there.
Well, thank you for the compliment. I think that some of the things that I really try to focus on is, you know, staying in tune with your clients and social media. And, you know, that's something that as attorneys, we use that in our practice as well. So you have a familiarity with that as a business person. So you understand that that's something that you can use to positively affect your business. And, you know, people that are in the CPG space, good founders and people that are building the business know that as well. I think the other thing too is you've got to stay abreast of the different products and, you know, products that are coming into play or becoming more important. Like, I'll give examples here. You know, you've got a lot of protein, different alternative proteins instead of beef. We've got different things coming into play beyond soy. And you see IPOs that are out there today for these companies. Beyond Meat is one of them. These are all different companies, and you've really got to stay abreast of those different changes and challenges that are coming through the consumer space that are affecting really how we're not only how we're purchasing products as consumers, but you know, how we're thinking about purchasing products. So I think it's all of those things. The other thing that I would say that has been very useful for me is that I've been involved in something called a CPG accelerator. And you may be familiar with accelerators in other spaces, but for CPG, there's oftentimes incubators or accelerators who foster CPG companies, and they bring them in sort of the fold and teach these companies and mentor them how to take a product or a recipe and really ramp it up and teach them about social media, teach them about branding the product, teach them about building a business model, all of those different things. And I was very fortunate enough to be involved in an accelerator in Austin called SKU, where I did the legal work for them. And I was very involved with the different companies that came into the accelerator for, you know, whatever particular round or group was coming in during that session. And I learned a lot. And it's really a great way to stay abreast of the trends that are going on, the products, learning about different founders, how they start their business, where they're going. I mean, it was just a great experience.
What are your favorite niches right now in CPG?
Well, the one that I like, and I just mentioned that, is the alternative protein sources that are coming on. And like I said, you've got the Impossible Burger. In fact, I think that's got a relationship, or they've got a relationship with one of the big hamburger chains. I think it's Burger King. And so a lot of the stuff that we used to maybe think of as like, oh, that's the niche product, only people that are, you know, vegetarians are going to eat that. Well, some of these things that are habits of what we used to think of as a niche group of people is now becoming mainstream. And so some of those things, like the alternative protein sources, alternative milk sources. There's some language in front of the FDA right now about whether we can call things that are made of oats, can we call that milk, or is milk only from a dairy cow? So there's all these different areas where we've got alternative sources of what we thought was maybe, you know, meat and milk when we were growing up or when we were kids, is now meaning milk and meat in different ways. And so those are two areas that I particularly like. I also like the organic space, where organic has become such kind of a darling of so many different products, and people really, really believe in organic lifestyle. And they, if they're going to build a product, they want it to be organic because that's what they believe in. And that is a great space to be in, but there's also a lot of rules and regulations from the FDA built around having an organic product and calling it organic. And that's something that I can help clients with, and I've helped a lot of clients with. And it is important to have an attorney who specializes in the CPG space, who's familiar with FDA regulations related to, you know, calling a product organic and marketing it as such.
Yeah, FDA, FTC, there's the whole regulatory side of this as well. It takes more than a great idea, and you've got to be able to navigate the different regulations that might affect your particular product. I mean, that's always going to be a part that most of the people who get into product development learn only later, right? There's so many barriers they have to get over. Let's talk about another barrier, which is one that virtually every company faces, which is getting funded. What is it that you would recommend for a small growing CPG company to do as they try and pursue and identify funding resources?
I think that's, you know, that is sort of for a lot of companies. They're doing so many things right, and yet they feel like they're not getting funded, or they're not getting, they're not ramping up as quickly. And so they worry that they need to be funded faster. And that is the reality. I mean, the funding does need to happen. I think the answer for a lot of companies, and it's an answer sort of, you know, that often in life, it's who you know. And successful networking is a large part of the answer to CPG companies getting funded. And the founders do need to get access to capital. You know, they've got the credit lines typically established and so forth, but that's not going to fund them forever. Perhaps a friend of a friend knows someone who can introduce them, introduce those founders to individual investors, or as we spoke about before, maybe there's an angel and a local angel investing club that they can get involved in. In Austin, there's a group called Central Texas Angel Network, which does have interest in CPG companies and also technology. And so that's oftentimes kind of a friendly space for CPG groups that are looking to get attention, or at least have someone spend some time with them and look at their product portfolio and really decide if that's something they'd be interested in. Another option is what we just talked about, and that was me, you know, back when I was relating my experience related to SKU, which is, as I said, an Austin accelerator, is getting involved in a CPG accelerator. These are really coming on. I mean, you know, even just 5 years ago, there used to only be a few accelerators across the country. Now they're really dominating and they're coming into a lot of cities. And a big reason for that is a lot of the big manufacturers, Nestle is one of them, General Mills is one of them, Chobani is one of them. These are all companies that understand that having products that are sort of on the front line of the trends for what consumers are looking for is where they need to be, because traditionally those companies have had, you know, research and development where they've developed their own products and brought those forward. But that can be a very time consuming and lengthy process, and getting attached to smaller companies who may kind of fit into what the big corporation is looking for, and the space that they're looking to get into, it can be a very much a win-win for both parties, where the corporation is looking to get in a space that the small CPG company is already in. And maybe once they meet, this could be something that could work out well for both parties. And sometimes those introductions are made at accelerators where corporate sponsors oftentimes participate. Sometimes they're hosting the accelerator. Sometimes they're a partial sponsor. And they like to meet founders. Many of the companies, the big corporations, have their own venture arm where they have a group of people that routinely go to accelerators or meet with founders of small companies to learn more about them. And then, you know, they follow the companies, and maybe they follow them over time, and maybe the relationship becomes more than just, you know, acquaintances. Maybe they get into business together. And so these are all good ways for founders to expand their horizons and network, but also consider other ways to get involved with corporations. I think the caveat here would be to remember that a lot of times when you get involved with an accelerator, it's a great learning experience, and you're going to usually network with a lot of people and make really good contacts. But typically you have to give up an equity percentage to the accelerator, because it's, you know, it's not a free service. There's going to be some advantage to them as well. And most of the time, the stake that the accelerator is going to take is around 5%. And so as a small company, you know, if that's something that you can live with at the time, because you and your other founder need a lot of help growing the business and understanding the business aspects of it, and you need good mentors, sometimes it can be a very good answer.
Yeah. Lori Orton Heath, of counsel attorney to Travers Legal and specializing in CPG, has been our guest today, and really fascinating stuff. I am not an expert in CPG. I'm more on the tech side. So speaking, Lori, with someone that's got this expertise is not only educational for our listeners who we love, who follow the podcast, but for me as well. So really thank you for being on the show today. Let me know what your final thoughts are, your final words or comments for CPG companies or startups as they roll out.
I think the most important thing is, and we touched on this a little bit earlier, is the most important asset for anybody that has a CPG company or is thinking about it is to remember that your most important asset is the brand equity that you have in the product or the products. And that brand equity can always be considered part of the intellectual property, and that intellectual property is going to have value. Maybe you don't see it as having much value today, but it over the long term, it can be very, very valuable to the company. And so, you know, you may get disheartened perhaps when your sales aren't where you think they should be at a certain point in time, but as it continues to grow, the brand equity grows with it. So the second point I would make is always remember to meet with an IP attorney to discuss your product and to protect that product imagery, slogans, and the like. And then also do invest time to work with a CPG attorney who can help you with some of the things we've talked about today, but also give you guidance on proper labeling, advertising, and promotion of your product so that you're within the proper regulations per the FDA and also the FTC, which you mentioned as well. So those are two good things, I think, to do and to remember. And I wish anybody that's out there that's got a CPG company that they're looking to start or they're currently in business, I wish you good luck. And it's an exciting time to be in that space.
Anyone that would like to contact Lori can do so, traverslegal.com, fill out the contact form, pick up the phone and call. And Lori would be happy to talk to you and give you her best thoughts and advice. And of course, if it turns out that there's a project that Lori can help you with, she'll tell you what it's going to cost and what the scope is so that you can set your budgets. That's all for the Tech Law Podcast today. We always like to thank our listeners for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Tech Lawyer Podcast, sponsored by Traverse Legal PLC, a law firm representing clients like you on matters just like yours. You can find the Tech Lawyer Podcast on most podcast listening platforms, including your home devices. Until next time, remember that good attorneys win for their clients. Great attorneys tell you up front how they're going to do it and how much it will cost.